I got way deeper than I was
expecting. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it was such a, I started to get a little worried. I mean, I think it was a really interesting discussion. I hope it comes across the same way that it came across in my head, but we'll find out.
I'm sure we'll get some angry letters or emails about that.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the podcast about video games recently rated 5 stars on iTunes by somebody on the internet. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also very lucky to have Scott Stevenson, software engineer, designer, and longtime gaming fan. Scott co-hosts Low Earth Orbit, a fine podcast that reviews movies, comics, and games. Hi, Scott.
How's it going?
It's great. Today is excellent. So our topic for today is game reviews and game criticism, which is something that's kind of been under my skin to some degree for quite a while. And I wanted to sort of bring you guys and try and help us solve all the problems in the game criticism and review industry just by discussing it on this podcast.
That seems pretty... So just solve all the problems, you said?
Yeah. Okay, we'll come up with a solution.
Low bar. Okay.
Yeah. I think that we're qualified.
We do have like a whole 45 minutes to an hour to do that. That ought to be plenty of time.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure no one has thought of these things before. So something that's kind of, I think, is a prototypical complaint about this is this general issue with games reviews in particular, that they're graded on this curve that, if a game is a 9 out of 10, then that's a good game. An 8 out of 10 is kind of meh. And like a 7 out of 10, that's like, oh, that's terrible. Don't play that game. And that's something that just drives me crazy. And a good example of it from recently, in my mind at least, is this Assassin's Creed 3. So this is a game that got 85% on Metacritic, which, like, if you're in school, that's an A. Like, you got 85%. Like, it must be, like, really good. It could only be 15% better.
When I was in school, 85 was only a B.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I think, B plus or something like that. Yeah, for me, I think it was, like, 89 was A minus.
I think 85 was an A minus at SFU when I was there.
And they literally graded on a curve.
But it's 85 is pretty good. Like, if you get 85%, you should be like, wow, that person really knows what they're doing. And you would think if a film got 85% positive reviews from critics, it's probably a really good film. Like, that's, you know, and once you start getting to 90%, then you're getting to, like, best picture nominees are getting that, right? So this is what this game gets. And so, as an example, from the IGN review, they rated it 85%. They gave it 8.5, which on their scale means great. 8 or more means great. And if you actually read the review, there's like all this sort of like discontent. Like, one of the quotes from it is, perhaps because Assassin's Creed 3 is so huge, it can be inconsistent. It attempts an astonishing amount, but it doesn't always succeed. Another thing they say is pop-in, frame rate drops, and occasional graphical glitches is definitely part of the experience. And so, like, does that sound like a great game, or does that sound like an ambitious game?
Yeah, the other thing I want to mention before we get too deep into that, for me personally, I think when I see an 8, I don't think of that as, I think for me, like, 7 is sort of the mediocre range. So, like, for me, 8, 9, 10 are all kind of easy slam dunk choices. For me personally, I don't know. Maybe we could talk about how people sort of read into what that number means to them individually. but for Assassin's Creed, you know, I think there's probably something to do there with the fact that it's this long-running AAA series. So people expect sort of the top of the top that they wouldn't necessarily expect from sort of a smaller developer. So maybe the problem there is that, you know, it's sort of there's some commentary to be made if it's not a 9. Like, it's the same in the same sense that, like, what if a Mario game is a 7? You know, that's a story for them, and a lot of it is, I think, personal. You know, what the author thinks is sort of personally interesting and what their personal biases are. But I think it's a really fair point about something like that, which is, you know, if you give it an 8, you expect the vast majority of the review to be glowing, you know, and kind of hide some or, you know, mention a few shortcomings, which is what I, you know, that's usually what I think when I see an 8. I think that that's the type of game I'm getting.
Yeah, as opposed to, hey, it's like, so if you haven't played Assassin's Creed 3, it's kind of the low point in between Assassin's Creed 2, which was like really revolutionary in the sort of gameplay and stuff, and Assassin's Creed 4, which sort of seems to have figured out a lot of the problems. But in 3, there's just, I don't know, I was pretty frustrated. I didn't finish the game, which, I don't know, that's another subtopic. Do I get to have an opinion about the game if I don't finish it?
you know, it's funny, too, because I used to watch a podcast for years called Totally Rad Show. Did you guys ever see this?
No.
Okay. One of my favorite podcasts ever. And one of the things I really liked about their approach to games is that they didn't ever, and actually I think this sort of influenced what some of the decisions we made for Low Earth Orbit, is whenever they reviewed games or movies, they didn't give it a number score. They basically just talked about what they liked about the game, what they didn't like, and then sort of ended on, you know, would they recommend it? Are they going to go back to it? And Assassin's Creed 3, just by utter coincidence, I happened to watch that episode again a few days ago, and they loved the game. I mean, they talked for 20 minutes about all the depth of the game, the different things you could do, the sort of the variety of locales, the fun they had, you know, all that kind of stuff. And in, you know, that's my mental picture of what the game is, having not played it yet. And you know, it's for me, having watched that show so much and understood what their sort of individual interests are, for me, that's a much more compelling story than looking at the Metacritic score. Although that's interesting, you know, it's a data point. It's not, in my mind, it's not enough to sort of make a final decision.
There definitely is an issue that so much of it is subjective, right? Like, part of the problem with Assassin's Creed 3 for you is that you just didn't like it that much. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad game. It just means that the problems that it had are things that particularly bothered you and that don't necessarily bother everyone else. You know, you called out a couple of specific things in the review, like graphical glitches and pop-in and stuff like that. And I think that's, like, if those are the most substantive criticisms that you can come up with, then probably the game does deserve an 85. Like, you don't review the film stock that they recorded Citizen Kane on. Like, in a big open world game, like, some graphical glitches and pop-in and stuff like that are the order of business. Like, there's going to be stuff like that, and there's not a huge amount that you can do about it. So that seems to me like pretty weak sauce criticism of a game like that. So yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a problem that they liked the game more than you did, and that they called out few things that are, you know, that were problems that aren't really significant. Like, did they say, oh, you know, the first little bit of the game seems to move really slowly, for example, which is one of the things that I think is a problem with Assassin's Creed 3, right? It's got a very big opening with the opera house section, and then kind of goes in the doldrums for the rest of the Haytham stuff and doesn't pick up again until you become Connor, right?
Yeah, they say, and I actually pulled that quote, and it says, Assassin's Creed 3's pacing is a source of frustration for the first third or so. It takes too long to open up and show its hand, which, like, by the time I got, like, a third of the game is pretty close to the average length that people get through a game. I've heard various stats. They range from, like, a third to maybe two thirds. But, like, a game like that, most people don't beat it. So if the first third of the game is slow and plodding and you don't really have a lot of motivation, like, why am I doing this? And, like, they have a reason for why they did that. But by the time they got to the I got through that section and then started, okay, well, now I have a homestead. That's cool. And then I made the horrible mistake of trying to spend some time doing trade goods, which sounded like the game encouraged me to do. And I actually spent some time doing it, and it was total chaos. And just, and everyone agrees, like, oh yeah, that part of the game sucks. Don't play that game. But when it's kind of like, all right, I'm almost tired of this game. Oh, here's the little interesting part. And then it's kind of like, oh, actually that's a bad part. You don't want to play that part, you know?
You know, I think that's an interesting point, too, that Nigel started to kind of hint at, which is that there's sort of two ways, I think, that people tend to approach writing review. And one tends to weight more heavily on sort of the you know, I don't know how to explain it, but like technical merit or like, you know, the correctness of making the game, and avoiding things like pop-in and all those other kind of, you know, bag of potential technical missteps. But the other way to do it is sort of approach it from the perspective of, okay, well, what if I'm not grading the, you know, technical proficiency of the developer, but instead I'm just trying to tell the person reading the review, will you have fun playing this game? Because, I mean, maybe in the sense that, you know, it can break suspension of disbelief, something like pop-in would matter, but it's not like it's the pop-in game. You know, it's not like that the entire, like, game mechanic or the story or anything else is seriously hampered by something like that. And, you know, I think the other part of that, too, is that there's probably a tremendous amount of pressure on reviewers and some of these big name sites to not just sort of come off as, you know, assigning Assassin's Creed 3 a perfect 10 just because it's Assassin's Creed 3 and they spent 3 years on it or whatever. You know, so I kind of understand that as well, is that they want to be, you know, accurate criticism of the mistakes of the game. But it's this weird balancing act between, you know, well, who's your actual audience? Is it like the extreme hardcore, you know, game developer community, and they're sort of evaluating each other? Or is it really just the person who's, you know, at GameStop thinking about buying Assassin's Creed 3 and saying, oh, you know, would I have fun doing this? Let me look at the score, or look at the review, I should say. And if they're, you know, if all the focus is on the technical issues, that probably is actually sort of misleading them as to what their experience is going to be.
Sure. The technical issues is an interesting thing. And in that review, they go on to talk about there's like significant like bugs and, you know, that interfere with some of the missions, which is the thing actually that I experienced that frustrated. I didn't notice as much the technical like pop-in and stuff like that when I was playing. But there was a couple of missions where like a guy is supposed to follow you and he just doesn't. And it's just like, okay, it tells me to go over here and he just doesn't follow me. And he's like, we shall go to the inn. And then he just doesn't walk. And then I like reload the game. And he still doesn't. I don't remember. I ended up doing some crazy thing or had to look online how to like glitch the game into continuing and things like that.
Oh, you tried multiple times and it didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't okay. Just like it got off on. And I ended up having to climb over something and like, you know, those are things in games where, you know, you're just breaking the fiction of the game in order to move forward. It was like, okay, if I fall off this roof and then I immediately open the door before the guard actually sees me, then the guards will leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know,
that kind of stuff seems like such a common problem, though, in open world games in general. I mean, Fallout was, you know, notorious for these kind of crazy bugs. But at the same time, I mean, I think, I don't remember the exact scores, you know, both those Fallout games got. But I think they're pretty, you know, they're pretty widely considered some of the best accomplishments of that genre, in retrospect at least.
That's the same sort of thing as the graphical glitching stuff I was talking earlier. Is you have to grade a little bit on a curve on some of the individual features depending on the genre. Like to me, criticizing an open world game for having pop-in is, you know, it's like criticizing water for being wet. It's just not it's not useful criticism. All open world games are going to have some of those kind of weird mission breaking bugs in them. There's just too many things you can do in too many orders for a few of those not to slip through. So saying that there's some of them isn't useful criticism. Now, if there's, you know, there's a boundary to that, obviously, particularly with the mission break sort of bugs. Like I never get frustrated in an open world game if that happens like once in a mission, right? If I'm doing a mission and it's like, why isn't this guy walking? Something weird's going on. And then I restart that mission and it works right the second time. I'm like, eh, just one of those things. If you've got a, you know, if you've got an individual mission that's just obviously badly broken, which I didn't encounter any of those in Assassin's Creed 3, but there's certainly, you know, I certainly can imagine there being some. I've encountered variations on that in other open world games in the past. Yeah, that's, you know, that's a problem, but it's a way less significant problem, or at least something you should be, you know, nicer to the developers about on an open world game than, say, a very linear first person shooter kind of game, right? Like if there's a mission breaking bug in Call of Duty, that's pretty significant. If there's a mission breaking bug, if you happen to do things in just the right order in one of the side missions in Assassin's Creed, like, that's, you know, that's not like, oh, the developers are morons that were completely asleep at the switch. That's just, those kind of games are hard to make bulletproof in that way.
Yeah, and all three of us are developers, so we can empathize. When I see a bug, I often, like, pretty immediately, like, oh, yeah, it's that kind of bug, or, you know, I understand, oh, yeah, I can see why that would, and even better, sometimes I'm like, oh, it's probably that kind of bug, so it'll probably be fixed if I do this kind of thing. Oh, yeah, okay, now.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, I definitely find myself thinking, like, how can I update the state of this character?
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe if I freeze them and then they unfreeze. Oh, okay, yeah, now then it's fine.
Although it's funny, have you guys run across the Double Fine game Hack and Slash? Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, just a quick little side note. Like I watched a video on it the other day, and it looks like the game mechanic is like you're hacking the game itself. It's very like fourth wall busting, but it seems like the sort of thing that we're talking about, where we're trying to kind of trick the game into working correctly. It seems like that's actually the core gameplay mechanic. I was going to look more at that.
But that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry to derail the conversation.
No, that looks cool. Cool. I'm definitely link that up in the show notes. So related to bugs and these sort of issues where you release a game, you play through it, and you're trying to get a sense of either you're writing a review or just figuring out, should you recommend this game to other people? And you hit game-breaking bugs or glitches or problems or performance issues. But the developer says, oh, okay, well, you know, that's because it's a 1.0, that'll be fixed in a patch. And this is especially true, a problem when you have a game like Skyrim or something that's so insanely complicated, it's literally impossible for it not to have bugs that you encounter. How realistically can you review a game that has serious issues that they claim they'll fix? Like, oh, I see so many reviews that say, oh, it had this problem, but they say that they're going to fix that.
Yeah, that's such a tricky area. I mean, I think it's responsible of a reviewer to mention that that's what they were told, you know, because then at least it's on the record, you know, and if you look 3 months down the line and the issue's still not addressed, then at least everybody's sort of above table about what the reviewer was told and what the expectations were. But it shouldn't adjust the actual final score, I think. I mean, I think that obviously is misleading. The one interesting thing about the phenomenon you're talking about and sort of the patching that's the case with like the last two generations is on consoles anyway, is Polygon has this policy of sort of like updating the reviews as things change.
Yeah.
Which sometimes is the review becomes radically different in the case of, I think it's like SimCity was one of those, and yes. Battlefield, I think, might have been another one. Which
where
is
the servers start going down. Like, mm-hmm. If there's only 8 people in the world reviewing the game, hey, the servers are really fast, and then they start melting and you can't play, and your game saves are not even saving. And
yeah. Yeah, and it's I don't know, I kind of feel like that concept may need to be taken even a bit further in the future, if not by Polygon, then somebody. I mean, I think I don't have it in front of me right now, but I believe they actually will show you what the review history is of the game if you sort of dig down a little bit. But I wonder if that has to be maybe even a little bit more formalized, particularly in games that now are like hitting, you know, Steam Early Access. A lot of alpha stuff is going online, and a lot of stuff is like online dependent, where conditions can constantly change. It seems like that might have to become less of sort of an tacked on thing on reviews and kind of be more the central theme, at least for some games. It's such a, you know, tricky area because it does really affect your decision about whether you're going to buy and play the game. But at the same time, it's so difficult for a reviewer to sort of, you know, encapsulate that idea inside of something that's basically a static review.
We should require reviewers to write a load testing script.
Please show your work. Yeah.
I do think that that sort of thing is one of the things that's sort of gotten game criticism to the state it is today compared to, say, something like film criticism or literary criticism, is that there's a bunch of issues that game criticism has to deal with that those other genres really don't, that come out a lot of those just logistical things, right? You know, someone can be shown a movie and, you know, spend the next day writing the review of it and then publish it. And so as long as they've got a cut ready to go for critics, like 3 or 4 days before the movie's released, then the critics can probably produce a review of it. Games, sometimes it's going to take a week for a reviewer to even play through a game. And you've got these issues of, okay, there's all this lag time at various points in the manufacturing cycle, and there's issues of how the games are being distributed to the reviewers that make it so that, yeah, the game can have a, the game reviewer can have a buggy version, you know, a buggy pre-release version of the game that the patch hasn't gone live for yet, but you know the patch is going to be live on day one, so no one's going to have that same experience that the reviewer does, and there's all these weird logistics issues that make game criticism oftentimes a lot more like a Consumer Reports style product review of, like, does this thing function the way it's supposed to, as opposed to like an artistic, is this game interesting thematically or is it good?
Yeah, although it has to have that stuff as well, which makes it even more complicated.
It's almost like they should have two scores, like how good this game would have been in theory and then how good it really was.
And, the potential score and the actual score.
And that's part of what you're doing if you say, like, I encountered these bugs, but I have reason to believe that they will be fixed by release time. Then that's sort of what you're saying, right? Is you're reviewing a version of the game that doesn't exist because you trust the developers to fix some of those problems. Or you're, on the flip side, you're reviewing a version of the game that doesn't exist because you're in an environment where there's only you and the other game reviewers on the server, and the server's going to fall over as soon as real people start using it, right? You're always kind of reviewing, yeah, where you're reviewing something that doesn't exist, which is not true of most other forms of criticism. You're, yeah, I mean, there's some variations on that, that, you know, maybe a reviewer will have seen a film festival version of the film and be influenced by that in how they're reviewing the release version, but you're not seeing a totally different version of a film than your audience is going to be seeing when you're reviewing it, whereas you could be to some degree in games criticism.
Although, you know, I think that actually brings you hit an interesting point there, which is that all the differences that you would consider with games versus films, I mean, there's a whole list of things, but one of the more interesting ones there is, you know, oftentimes part of the review, or kind of a lacking part of a review, is comparing the reviewed version, so like the Xbox version, to the version that the reader is probably going to actually play, which is the PS4 version. And sometimes that's actually addressed. You know, they actually say, well, we're reviewing, you know, the PS4 version. We can't speak to the version you're actually going to be buying, or we've looked at it and it basically seems the same, but it's this weird, like, black hole for the reader where they're just sort of left to their own devices and say, well, you know, I guess they reviewed this version of the game and theoretically it's the same, but it's not actually always the case, particularly between the different online services and, you know, what the performance characteristics are in certain areas of the game. And it's strange how that's sort of like not addressed, which is, you know, it's something that honestly actually is a problem for the film industry. Like, you can, you know, the reviewer might see a really fantastic digital projection of a new film, and then, you know, the actual consumer goes to a theater and they miss all the elements that the reviewer saw, which actually could affect their overall impression. A friend of mine works at Pixar, and this the pivotal moment of this for me was he invited me to a screening of Ratatouille before it was out, and I went, you know, to see it at Pixar, and they have this phenomenal, you know, Lucas sound system built in there. And it was, I don't know if you guys remember the movie. I assume you've seen it.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen it.
And very, very early on in the movie, like in the first, I think, 15 minutes or something like that, Remy's going down the drain pipe, and he sort of hits a series of, I guess, like effectively waterfalls, and, you know, gets dropped in the water. And there's part of that scene, and, you know, at least when I originally saw it, part of the impact of that scene was he would go over the waterfall and hit the water, and the concussive force of the water hitting him came through so, like, not violently, but so strongly in the speakers that it actually affected my impression of that scene.
You can feel the thump.
Yeah, exactly. And then later on, I actually went to see it a second time, just like at some AMC or something like that. And I was like, wow, this scene is not nearly as strong, you know, without the gigantic multi-million-dollar sound system. And I, you know, back to the original point is I wonder, particularly now since we're kind of between, you know, console generations in a way, I wonder how much of that actually impacts the consumer when they read about a version of the game that was reviewed on the PS4 copy, and then they go out and buy the PS3 one. You know, like how does that get addressed? And I don't have an answer, but it's just
That's totally a big impact, and it even goes beyond what system you play it on, but like how you play it. If you play a game like Journey, which is like a 3-hour thing where you just completely immersed, and like for a lot of people, if they just sit down and the kids have gone to bed and you're just in a room by yourself and you play it for those 3 hours, like at the end of it, you're like, you know, you're crying at like how emotionally amazing this was. But if you try to play it like in like a few, like half an hour bursts, and you're distracted and the phone rings or you're talking to someone, you're checking Reddit and the kids are running around and you have this music in the background, then you're not going to get that at all.
Yeah.
And like that's user error, but it's a totally different experience.
Yeah. That's actually one of the things that I think my fears have sort of been addressed to some degree recently with Journey's a really good example. But that's, I think, my biggest concern about sort of, you know, casual games in general is, you know, I think people that hadn't really played games before, so like, let's say, Xbox 360 early era or something like that, if they never really got into that, but then with the rise of mobile games, they started kind of dipping in to different things. I'm a little bit concerned that they would, you know, take those games that you play for maybe 5-10 minutes at a time, you know, between, you know, at a bus stop or whatever it is, and, you know, do that over a period of time, and they sort of internalize that of what gaming is and completely miss out on the idea of, you know, what Journey is a great example, you know, what Journey can be, or what something that actually maybe is 10 hours long or something like that, and how you can have an experience as the characters develop over that period of time. You know, for me, that for me is the most interesting part of a lot of the games I play. And I have been, although recently not as concerned, I have in the past been concerned that somebody might just be entirely missing out on that because they only play Angry Birds, you know, for 5 minutes at a time, and don't know that there's this whole other thing available to them. And as a result, you know, sort of a meta discussion there is, like the thing you're talking about, you know, are, if they play a well-reviewed game only 10 minutes at a time, is that experience going to match up to the thing that reviewer did, which is almost certainly they sat down for hours at a time and played.
Yeah, for sure.
This also ties into an issue that's come up before, which is this idea that games are skill gated to a degree that other media aren't, right? That someone who plays a lot of games on their phone, sort of casual games and stuff like that, may, you know, may not occur to them that there's richer experiences to be had longer form on gaming consoles and stuff like that. But it's also entirely possible that they're not like capable from a dexterity standpoint of playing those games. Something like Journey, I don't think that is true of. It is a pretty accessible game that doesn't require a lot of skill to play through it, but there's plenty of other really good games like Last of Us and Bioshock Infinite, which are two that have come up a couple times before. They're two of my favorite games of last year. Both have a very high skill bar. Like, they're pretty hardcore sort of games. They're not something that a casual game player can necessarily be successful at, even if they decide they want to, even if they say, yeah, I've heard really good things about this and I want to try it, I want to have a richer experience. Like, they just might not be capable of it if they're not experienced game players.
Yeah, I remember seeing, I didn't actually read the extent of the article, but I remember running across an article right when Bioshock Infinite came out. And I'm sure there are many articles that were sort of in a similar vein, which was basically the author was concerned that there's this really interesting idea, story presented in Bioshock Infinite that should be available to a wider audience, but it won't be because most people aren't first-person shooter players. And, you know, I think I actually may have run across it from Ken Levine's Twitter feed, and he had, you know, he basically, his stance on this was, you know, this is what we're making, which I think is a fine decision to make. You know, if you're making the game, you get to decide what it is. But it was kind of funny because, you know, I think it's such a tricky thing because it's like, yeah, you could, and some games actually have tried to paper over that by, you know, basically having an easy mode or like an ultimate invincibility button mode or any range of options. But at the same time, it's strange because I wonder if you kind of miss out on the synthesis between those two things if it was somehow made more accessible. So like if you're not actually playing through Bioshock Infinite, but you know, if you had some sort of mode where you were, you know, just sort of basically walking through it, in a way it became like a point and click adventure in a way, you know, would you get the same sort of feeling out of it? Would you still feel like Booker? I don't know. I mean,
I think particularly with both of those games, because both of them have sort of like embraced the asshole protagonist, that in both of those cases, they've worked around this problem of your character being kind of a violent thug by actually making the character a violent thug in the game and making that sort of part of the world fiction. And I think I don't think you can really generate the correct emotions without the player doing that in some ways, that like mm-hmm. you kind of being those guys and doing these kind of horrible things are like, that's part of the experience of those games. Those ones, I mean, both of them do have really strong story components and don't tie in as much in the gameplay into the gameplay as that. But to go back to like the original Bioshock, the hook with that couldn't possibly work if you weren't playing the game, right? Yeah. Like that's the whole point, in a sense, of the original Bioshock, is that it's a commentary on how, like, what the structure of games is. And you couldn't tell that same story in like a point and click adventure way and have that come through nearly as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Let's do a sponsor, and then I have another game review, at least one other game review related thing I want to talk about. So this episode is brought to you by VanCoco. VanCoco is Vancouver's speaker series for iOS and Mac developers and designers. Next week's VanCoco is very special. We'll be welcoming the NS hipster himself, Panic's very own Matt Thompson, as well as Chris Parrish of The Record. If you'll be anywhere close to Vancouver on April 8th, RSVP now at www.vancoco.com. As of this recording, we have about 10 RSVPs open, and I think we'll probably open a few more up when this episode goes up. So, yeah, if you're even remotely close to Vancouver, it would be awesome to see you there. So the other thing I wanted to make sure that we hit on in this episode talking about game reviews is this idea of giving a score to a game that is lower than maybe the consensus would be, because you have a personal, I don't want to say vendetta, but you identified something that is a bad trend or attitude in the industry that this game is an extreme example of, and basically making an example of it. And this is a really controversial thing. So like maybe an extreme example or a particularly controversial example was Polygon's review for Dragon's Crown. Either of you see this business?
Yeah, I read it. Yeah.
So this is, for anyone who didn't see, this is a game where it's like a hack and slashy game, a fantasy game, and like it seems to be relatively reasonable. It's an indie game, and so you want to support it because it's an indie game. But this company has this art style, or I guess it's their art director or whatever, has this art style of rendering women in this sort of bizarrely grotesque way, that they're like 90% breast and like they're contorted in bizarre ways, and it's very bizarre and obviously sexist. So at Polygon, the woman who reviewed the game addressed this, and she's like, okay, well, there's some good things about the game, it's pretty good, and you know, spent a decent amount of the review on basically how the art style was kind of disgusting and just inappropriate and didn't make the game as fun as it would have otherwise been. And there was a lot of debate, and you know, there's obviously the inevitable, just like people being idiots and saying like, oh, you shouldn't play games, you're a girl, and all that ridiculousness. But you know, ignoring that, or maybe that's an interesting topic as well, but there's this sort of meta discussion of is a game review a good platform, or a reasonable platform, or a fair platform to try and enact change in the industry in that way. whether it's because this game is sexist or because it's abusing in-app purchase or because its menus are horrible and, you know, the rest of the game is fine. But there's this one thing that's just obviously a problem that needs to be fixed in the whole industry. And my personal opinion is that that's a, like, great. And I wish more reviews did that. I wish more reviews said, you know, this game is pretty good, but it has this really, you know, the industry has this problem and this particular game is really bad for it. And I want to, like, call out the fact that it takes like 15 minutes to even start playing because the menus are so bad. Like, I gotta give it like a 6 because, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I remember reading that review and, I haven't played the game. I was following it for a while and I don't think I realized up until that review, kind of to the extent that the art style is so over the top. But at the same time, like, it's such a tricky area. I mean, first off, the thing I did want to say is that, like, having looked at the rest of the game, like, it seems to me that everything is over the top. Like, the male characters, I mean, they have, what, like, 60-inch biceps and, you know, a chest that is, you know, basically the equivalent of 3 male chests, like, stuck together. So nothing in that game is art style wise is realistic or, you know, anything that any human could aim for in any way. So that, I mean, that to me at least strikes me as, noteworthy. But as far as, you know, the meta commentary on a trend or what you think should be a new trend in a game, I personally think that that's better as a separate opinion piece, because it just doesn't feel like the thing that the reader's kind of tuning in for, I guess, in a way. And I don't think there's any problem with linking to the opinion piece from that review. But to me, it just seems like a separate discussion, because if nothing else, it sort of shortchanges the discussion about the game for space constraints or whatever. And it I think it doesn't really do either one well in that case. So it doesn't really do the opinion piece as well as it could be done. It doesn't do the review as well as it could be done because they're trying to share the same space. And I mean, I'm mixed on it because it is kind of a very extreme case. And it would be weird to not talk about it at all in the course of the review. That it, you know, this is extremely sexualized style and it's really inappropriate, particularly for... you know, for I guess like a younger audience, but at the same time, you know, each person who looks at that is going to have a different reaction to it and a different opinion about it. And I think for me, one of the major downsides is that that's a really small developer, and I think they've been working on the game for like 4 years or something like that. And I could see how being somebody on that, you know, one of the developers on that team, you know, having what you believe is a really good game or a fun game, at least I should say. And then seeing that review, I mean, that could be, it's kind of demoralizing, you know, because of the decision that your art director made. And it's such a tricky area, you know, because there's clearly sort of a larger problem to be addressed here. And I think there's absolutely, it's a good thing to, you know, for somebody like Polygon to speak up about it. I'm just not sure if a game review is the best venue for that. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'm kind of torn in exactly the same way that I think, like, obviously the sexism of the games industry is an extremely important conversation to have, but I'm not convinced that a review of an individual game is the correct place to have it, at least in general. Like, again, this particular one I think is it's a really tough, you know, there's a famous saying in law, right, which is that difficult cases make bad law. You don't want to target the rules that you're making on the exceptional cases. And this is an exceptionally over the top sexualized art style that's really just ridiculous. And there isn't any way to talk about the game reasonably without mentioning, like, hey, you know, these women have breasts that are like larger than the rest of their body, and that's not really how women are constructed in the real world.
Well, I mean,
but to, in general, I don't think that reviews are a good way to address that sort of criticism, because it does tend to come off as picking on an individual game or picking on an individual aspect of the game to make a point. I think if you, you know, if you see, hey, this is a trend, then the right thing to do is to say, hey, here's, you know, here's a trend I've noticed. Here's some games that are part of that trend. Here's why I don't like that trend. Here's what I think could be done to improve that trend, and make that a separate thing that you're talking about. Anytime in a review that you say, hey, here's something that this particular game is doing that I don't like, it, yeah, it becomes kind of mean to those developers over other people that are making the same mistakes. And
but what better motivation to enforce like improvement in the game industry and the games that we see than the games getting less sales because their review scores are lower, right? Like if games have bugs versus if games have unappealing art styles or, you know, any other problem, like I feel like that's kind of one of the few levers that, you know, critics in the industry have to try and improve. Like that's the point of criticism. Like criticism is supposed to improve. It's not just like trying to be mean. Like I want to get back at these people for making this.
Well, but I think that's maybe a little bit, it's a little bit unfair because in particularly in a case like Polygon, they have so much influence. And it basically, in this case, and I think pretty much every review, it comes down to one person's opinion. And I think there's something to be said about what the developer can reasonably expect the reception to be. Certainly with bugs, that's basically a binary thing. You know, we've told you the game is going to do one thing, and it doesn't do something else. Or, I'm sorry, and it does do something else. But when it comes down to sort of, you know, your interpretation of art, literally, I mean, the problem is that there's two things that are intersecting there. One is the Metacritic review basically determines whether people get to continue doing their jobs in a lot of cases. And the other thing is sort of this, well, you know, how do I personally feel about the game? And I think when you put all that weight on one person and, you know, and particularly in such a high profile case like Polygon, you know, I don't know if that who, I mean, it, I guess in a way it does potentially advance visibility on a particular issue, but I don't know if it's fair to use that as sort of a wedge, you know, to sort of get attention to something that, in I don't know, it doesn't seem totally above table to do it that way. You know, it's like if it's an important enough issue, then why not just write a separate piece on it? You know, and even make it available from the review. But I think even if you feel very strongly about an issue, I don't know if it's a legitimate use of the review space for something that's not the review.
There's a difference between a review and criticism, right? And that's, that tension is part of this whole thing into why criticism in the games industry is kind of screwed up. Is there's always this pressure to like pump this number out the end. And so much of what the game companies are doing in terms of how they're tracking their success is tied into these numbers that come out the back end, right? That when you're in a situation like that, you know, the number is very important. And if you say, okay, well, there's one aspect of the game for this reviewer that that ruined their experience of it, like absolutely they should say that in the review. Like there's no reasonable argument to be made that the reviewer should have glossed over that and shouldn't have said that it made her feel uncomfortable. And like, that's ridiculous. But at the same time, she's now assigning a number that's very important to the success of that developer. And other people that are interested in that game that aren't bothered by the art style decisions that they made, the game's going to be somewhat buried for those people because of this controversy. And like I said, this game's not a great litmus test for that because it's so over the top and so ridiculous and so sexist that, or at least the art style is, I have no idea if the game itself is particularly sexist, that, you know, maybe it's not a good example. Like maybe it's one that did deserve the flack. I just don't know if game reviews are a great place to try and make social change. I think reviews, to a certain degree, have to always approach the object being reviewed on its own terms. You know, you can't review like a big summer action blockbuster and a little indie drama the same way. You have to know which one you're going into and give it the review score that deserves based on what it achieves on its terms. And
you mentioned something before that seemed true, but I'm not entirely sure what it means, which is that which is the idea that a game review and game criticism are different. And I guess that goes back to what we were talking about before, that to some degree, game reviewing games is like a Consumer Reports thing. Like, okay, does it actually have the features that it said it would? And does it really actually, you know, is it possible to complete the game and all that kind of stuff? But what is not game criticism actually the more important function than game review? Like, in the sort of big scheme of things, like, if it's, game reviews are just like, if games reviews are basically just like a product spec sheet that is like, it has these features, it has this many quests, you know, this has this many combos that you can execute, and, you know, or something, that's of way less value to the world than sort of something that more the way that film reviewers do is like, okay, this is the context of this film, and these are the problems that it has, and, you know, it falls into this common summer blockbuster that there's no plot and it doesn't really make any sense, you know, or whatever. And like being able to actually have, and maybe that's a bad example because summer blockbusters with no plot actually can be pretty awesome, but, you know, that kind of thing where they're actually being an active force for improvement in the industry, as opposed to just from their personal perspective of like, these are the problems with films and this is film is doing it well or doing it wrong. Like, and then the whole point of Metacritic is that you smooth out those individuals' biases and the strong opinions. Like, you have one person who really, really hates games that are just excessively violent for no reason. Like, one of the things was we were talking about with the Tomb Raider game, Nigel and I, where there's a particular thing where you're going down a river, and that if you slightly are off too much to the left or the right, then every single time Lara Croft gets a spike through her throat over and over and over and over. And like, I watched that animation like 10 times. And I'm like, why are you showing this to me? And like, that decreased my enjoyment of the game more than the percentage of how many, like, I spent like 0.01% of my time playing the game watching that animation. But like, in a criticism, I would have to like criticize the game for that, as opposed to a review. It's like, well, yeah, you could eventually complete the thing, so I guess it's 10 out of 10.
Which is part of, I guess, my confusion about this issue is that obviously, you know, it's your reaction to that is personal, and it's going to be different for everybody else. And I think there's no way entirely for the developer to know what to expect from their audience. And I guess it strikes me as strange that, you know, like, why is the bar so much lower for, you know, social acceptability for violence in games versus sexualization? You know, like, why is the punishment from a reviewer so much higher? I don't know if it's right or wrong, or, you know, I don't have any answer to it, but it's surprising to me that, like, why does that not come up? You know, because that, for me, like, that that would be a reason for me not to play the game. But I don't remember ever reading that in any review about Tomb Raider, and I don't know why.
There was some pretty significant criticism of Tomb Raider at the time that it was released about how violently Lara was treated, particularly in the context of sort of the discussion of how women are treated in video games in general. I think the biggest spike of it happened well before the game was actually released, when they released a trailer for the game that had one of the early scenes where she's sort of semi-sexually menaced by one of the villains of the piece. And yeah, I would say there was a fair amount. I mean, I don't know that specific incident got called out, but definitely Tomb Raider falls into the trope of like the abused action hero, right? Like, there's a pretty straight line through from like Indiana Jones and John McClane and Nathan Drake and Lara Croft, of these heroes that get really beat up in the course of their adventures. And it's interesting how, you know, how different that's viewed by people when it's a woman who's the lead, right? That, yeah. I think in some ways that criticism was slightly unwarranted, because there's all these other examples of male action heroes that get abused almost exactly the same way. And when it's a female protagonist, and, you know, we're saying, like, hey, we're, you know, the industry is trying to, you know, trying to do better and trying to have these strong female protagonists. And then, you know, either depending on what your perspective on it is, they go a little too far and are a little too over sexual and over violent towards her. Or on the flip side, like, maybe people are just overreacting a little, that here's this female hero who's getting exactly the same abuse that the male heroes in the same, you know, they're sort of following the same genre and trope are, but everyone's up in arms about it because it's a woman. And I think there's arguments to be made that there's a little bit of both of those going on, right?
Yeah.
That the developers did go a little too far in some respects, but that also there's a little bit of sort of the benevolent sexism going on of like, oh, well, you shouldn't be that hard on a woman. Like I saw the animation of the zombie, like, eating the guy's face in Last of Us a lot more often than I saw that than I saw the spike going through Lara's neck, and I didn't think anything about it. But yeah, it kind of bugged me in the same way that it bugged Alan when I was playing the game.
There's a good article that I'll link up by Jeff Vogel. He has a blog called The Bottom Feeder. He's an indie developer, and the title is Tomb Raider, Torture Porn, and Looking for an Audience That Exists. And it deals with this probably better than I can. But and it's definitely a case to some degree of, yeah, games are always violent. And also there's to some degree that I just personally am uncomfortable watching her get the spike through her neck, as opposed to, like, you know, is it actually promoting violence against women? We're getting into, like, hot water and depth on this, but
yeah, the one little quick thing, you know, I think the thing that's interesting about Tomb Raider, particularly on, like, the PS4, for example, is that the goal is to make it, at least the character model and the world, extremely realistic. So for me, it's like that is a much more clear cut case to me, which is if there's a female protagonist and she's getting abused, I mean, that would make it difficult for me to play the game compared to Dragon's Crown. For me, I mean, those are completely over the top, fictional, off the wall characters that have no, you know, no basis in reality. So I guess for me personally, and granted, I'm the wrong person to make any commentary on this because I'm not, you know, I'm not the person that would be affected by it. But it's harder for me to see that as anything but cartoony, I guess, in a way. And maybe that was part of the reason I was sort of surprised by that review, is that it just seems like it has no basis in reality. It's hard to judge it as reality versus the Tomb Raider thing, which is that this is, you know, meant, you're supposed to come off with the feeling that Lara Croft is a real person. And so the things that happen to her and how she's betrayed and how she's, you know, rendered and all the kind of things, I think that's a reasonable discussion to have. And even in the sense of, you know, the Dragon's Crown review, you know, the topics that are brought up there, I think that, you know, when you're talking about Tomb Raider, it's a whole different discussion because it is supposed to be a real person. But
with I totally get that cartooniness. Yeah. Thing. Have you guys seen the game? It's been a couple years ago, old now. Fat Princess.
I watched the video for it. I never played it. Yeah.
When I first saw it, like, it's like this little cartoon princess, and like people try to, like, you know, each team I think has one, and you like feed her cakes or something like that, so she gets too big that the other team can't steal her. Which, when you say that, you're like, okay, yeah, I can totally see why people would be offended by that. But it was so cartoony that when I saw the trailer, I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people were like, yeah, there's probably some problems with that. I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah. But because it's cartoony, I thought of it very differently than, you know, Lara Croft. Like you say, you spend all this time getting into sort of the mindset of being her and just realism, and definitely a different feeling.
But again, in the case of Tomb Raider, I think the case for it being sexist is less clear than in the case of something like Fat Princess, because there's the well-defined genre of the downtrodden action hero. And in a way, what the developers are trying to do there is trying to not sexualize her by just saying, like, the same things are going to happen to her that would happen to a male hero in this same kind of, like, trapped and cut off and on their own sort of situation. And, you know, the danger of making a review a platform for that kind of criticism, like I said, I think, you know, we got to have this conversation, like, we got to fix this problem with the games industry, whatever the shape of the final solution turns out to be. But the problem with making you know, reviews the venue for doing that, to try and pull this back to the original point, is that something like that, like how you react to how they treat Lara in Tomb Raider, is a very personal thing, right? It's very much about what your, you know, your attitudes towards violence are. And yeah, I can see that certainly affecting some people very badly. And, you know, a review should call that out. But to me, saying, okay, well, this is something that affected me personally, so I'm going to drop a bunch off the review score for that, like, it seems particularly unfair in the case of that game, because I think there's so much more to be said for the Tomb Raider series in terms of what it's done to advance the cause of women in video games, that then turn around saying, like, oh, well, now they've gone too far. We've got to bring them, you know, cut them back down to size. Like, I don't know, a review just doesn't seem like the right venue for something like that. Like, you should review how the game plays, and if there's things that bothered you personally, like, feel free to call them out. But someone knocking like 5 or 10 points off their score of Tomb Raider because they didn't like that, it strikes me as really unfair to the developers. Like, it's something where they're, you know, they're saying, we're going to try and hurt the developers for something that's a personal reaction. And I think it's a better example than something like Fat Princess or something like Dragon's Crown, in that there's a lot more gray area in Tomb Raider, right? There's arguments to be said, to be made, like I said, both for there being some sexism in the portrayal, but also for it advancing the cause of female protagonists. And so, I don't know, knocking them down like that for that just seems kind of counterproductive to me.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I think, just to flip it around, I think, you know, what if somebody, some larger media outlet, going back to BioShock Infinite, you know, what if they took this game that I think is widely considered one of the best games in the last few years and said, well, you know, I really don't like the direction, the overall idea of, you know, so much rampant violence in video games, particularly first-person shooters. So, you know, I'm going to significantly take down the score based on the fact that I don't think this is a good trend. I mean, I think a lot of people would feel really hurt by that, you know, because this is, in a sense, it's the best thing that the industry has to offer. Not everybody would say that, obviously, but, you know, I think the general feeling is that it's a really great piece of art, really. And for some major media outlet took that viewpoint and injected it into their explanation of how good the game is as a whole. I mean, I think one, the issue is that, you know, a lot of us would feel it's unfair, but the other is, I think I kind of worry about self-censorship in general there. You know, if you constantly mix those things, it's like, well, we can't afford to not have this game sell well, you know, so, you know, what are the decisions we make? Again, Dragon's Crown is, I think, a totally different extreme case. I'm not talking about that one specifically, but, you know, even with something like Tomb Raider, you know, should they not have Lara go through some of these more action-y moments because they're concerned about sales? I mean, I think that would be a bad path to go down, you know, because then we just end up with Angry Birds, you know, if you fall through to conclusion. And it just means that we're kind of deprived of some deeper experiences. And
well, that's only true, though, if people are docking scores for things that are good, right? Like, if they're docking scores because they're like, yeah, this game, like, has too much variety, so -5 because I don't like that. It's like, oh, okay, well, then that's a bad influence on the industry. And I guess I'm sort of making this assumption that the things that people are docking scores for are things that are actually bad, and that if game developers start becoming worried that they're getting scores docked because it takes 15 minutes to even start the game every time you sit down because the menus are so Byzantine, then they stop doing that, like, that's excellent. Like,
yeah, well, but
I mean,
I don't want collateral damage
and kill some developer by accident, but, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's a wildly different thing. I mean, that's interaction versus content. I mean, the content, the thing that, you know, I think Nigel was talking about primarily with Tomb Raider is content, which, you know, is sort of the definition of what it is to be human, right? To have this wide range of experiences and different things that you can interpret in different ways, which are, you know, some people are going to like, some people aren't going to like. And I think having that wide range is part of the thing that makes games great. Totally different. You know, I think what you're talking about is a completely different topic, but I agree is that interactions are really difficult, or the menus are broken, or there are crashes or whatever. Yeah, you want the points to be docked for that, because that's going to be basically a universal experience for everybody, and that's not going to be up for internal or individual, you know, interpretation.
It's the Consumer Reports review model versus the criticism model again, right? That
right.
The current expectation is that reviews of games are sort of like product reviews, right? That they're not pieces of in-depth criticism that are trying to get at the heart of what the theme of the game is and how it fits into the larger picture. And I'm torn on whether or not that's like whether that's a good thing or not. Like I would like to see more in-depth criticism, but at the same time, all that adding more in-depth criticism to reviews tends to do right now is make the review not be particularly good criticism or a particularly good product review, right? If you say, I'm going to review this game and the main gameplay is X, but I go off on tangential issue Y that really bothered me about it for the whole review, then, you know, people that aren't going to be bothered by tangential issue Y aren't getting a very valid review, and people who are concerned about tangential issue Y, you know, it's not going to get the treatment necessarily that it deserves in terms of you know, looking at the various things that feed into that and the rest of the context within the industry or whatever else, because it's crammed into the format of, okay, here's the things I liked about this game, here's the things I didn't like about this game, here's a review score. Neither half of the critical equation is particularly well served by the current situation. People are trying to produce reviews that are both, and they're not really turning out to be good at either.
Yeah, no, I think that latter point is exactly, I 100% agree, which is that if nothing, I mean, yeah, it's sort of like they didn't do a great, you know, potentially they don't do a great job of reviewing the thing if they're doing this sort of larger commentary. But the biggest thing, I think, by far, is that you're not actually giving full service to the actual thing it is that you're talking about. You're trying to wedge in a complex topic into something that's sort of be a summarized view on something. So how weird is it to read, you know, what is essentially an opinion piece about the state of over-sexualization and sort of, you know, games that are hostile towards women, and then at the end seeing a review number, you know, it's such a bizarre thing to say, okay, well, here's this commentary and this discussion about this problem, and 8. And then it's like, wait, what? What does 8 have to do with anything that it is I'm looking at? But
you lose like 1 point per additional cup size that you've given your female protagonists?
Oh, or God.
Like, yeah, you know, how does that, what's the metrics here?
All right, that's the end.
But the one real quick, I think, important point about that review and just sort of a general polygon thing is that the authors actually don't choose the final number. So and I don't know how many people reading that review understood that, is that, you know, the author will actually, you know, write what they think it is important to talk about in the game, but the actual final score is actually determined by the editorial staff. So that, you know, that changed my reading of that review when I found that out.
Yeah, actually, I hadn't realized that either.
I think another thing that people don't entirely realize about the review scores is how significant the review scores are to sales for games. Like, that's the perspective I come at it from being in the AAA game development community for a while, is like those Metacritic numbers are really important. The difference in sales that you see based on where it is on Metacritic is astounding, right? And so, you know, I'm coming into that with a little bit of a defensive attitude of like, I don't want to see points docked for things that seem like side issues to me, whether it's whether it's something that's a, you know, sort of a personal or political kind of issue, or if it's a logistical issue that I don't think is significant, like a, you know, oh, there's these pop-in bugs or something like that. Like, in both cases, every reviewer that docks points for those is basically taking some money out of the out of the developers that made the game. And, you know, having been one of those developers, that that bothers me, because I think that a lot of times the where those things, you know, where those points come from are so much down to what the sort of by chance experience that the reviewer had of the game, either because of, you know, because of what things the game did or didn't speak to them about, or just random bugs that they encountered. And like, it's always, oh, if only they, you know, if only they'd gotten lucky and not encountered that bug, they, you know, they would have appreciated this game that I think's really deserving more, and the developers would have done better. But yeah, I mean, the scores are really important in the industry, I think is what it comes down to, that you can draw a straight line from what those scores are through to whether or not the game is successful. And
I appreciate that I'm calling for people to punish scores based on things that I don't like, yet I'm the person who sees a one-star review for one of our apps because they don't like the icon, and like, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, that's not a one-star review. Like, app's great, except the icon sucks. So it's like, okay, well. All right, so that's our time for today. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to review or criticize us, which I think maybe actually might be the case for some of you, please do rate us on iTunes or send an email to hello@upup.fm. See you next week. Playing any good games?
I started playing Infamous for PS4 last night.
Oh yeah!
Holy cow! What a fantastic game!
I heard a couple good things about it.
Yeah, I'm literally only like an hour in, so I really haven't started the real game yet. And I played part of, I shouldn't say part of, I played the majority of the very first Infamous, and I really liked it. It was a lot of fun. And but good God, I mean this one is just literally an entire generation forward. I mean it's gorgeous. I mean, it's the first game that I've really seen that is like, okay, this is what PS4 is actually capable of. Because, you know, I played Strider last weekend and finished it. Also highly recommended. Fantastic game. But it definitely felt like a PS3 game with like kind of PS4 flourishes. And it's clear that Infamous is from the ground up PS4, and not just actually the effects are fantastic and the world is fantastic and you know, all that kind of stuff that you expect. But the other thing that was really surprising, even just as, you know, being an hour in, is the acting is unbelievably good, like fantastically good. And that just, you know, the motion capture stuff that they did is really incredible, even in engine.
That's awesome. Yeah. Cable Sasser on Twitter said the other day that Infamous on PS4 doesn't actually show you that this game, your game is saving, like warning the game is saving icon on the screen. That would be, if that's true, that's really interesting, because on PS3 and Xbox, Xbox 360, I guess, previously, that was a rule. Like, if your game was going to get published on the platform, you had to have that freaking warning every single time. And if that's not there, then that means that it's actually not in the rules anymore, and they're actually able to trust the game to save a file successfully and atomically.
Although it's funny, because kind of an interesting side effect of that is I didn't know it was auto-saving. So like, one of the nice things about seeing that icon is you're kind of like, oh, okay, I'm at a checkpoint or whatever, I can stop. But when you don't see that, you know, yeah. I was kind of struggling last night. I'm like, can I like go to bed now? Like, I don't know what's going on.
And there's a nice tension if you don't know how much has saved, where you're a little more worried about dying. Like, ideally what you want is to think, like, in the back of your head, if I die right now, it's a big deal. But then if you do die, it's not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like there's some sort of, it's one of those leftovers of the previous generation. And it's like, oh yeah, I'm glad that's gone. But wait, actually, can I kind of have that back? Because that would be helpful.
You just want a little blip, like checkbox. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, what you really want is you want the saving icon to be there, but you don't want to have to see the screen every time you start up that says the saving icon is going to be there.
Oh man, the other, like maybe 2 or 3 months ago, I got a PS3 game I was excited to play. I popped the disc in, and like I did the system updates the night before because I really wanted to play it. I put the disc in to have it install, and I went and I had a shower or did make coffee or did some totally unrelated thing. I came back a while later, and it was just sitting on a screen that said, "Warning, this game saves automatically. Don't turn off your thing." Mm. Well, it's saving. And then I press X, and then it starts installing.
Jeez.
Great. Thanks.
Those kind of problems are probably going to get worse instead of getting better as, like, you know, now that you'll be purchased, people will be starting to purchase full games on digital download and stuff like that. Like, yeah, now you're going to have to sit through the whole, like, 40, 50 gig download sometimes.
I don't matter that much if they can make it so, like, I put this system in a state which is like, do all the shit you need to do in order to make it so I can play this game, and then I can sit down and then start the game, as opposed to this, like, put in the disc and it's like, this requires an update. And you're like, okay. And you're like, oh, actually, you need to sign in. Oh, actually, you can't sign in because you don't have the right PS version. Oh, okay, you need to update your operating system. It's like, oh, okay, now it needs to install. Okay, now it needs a different update. And, like, constant, like, modal dialog boxes popping up, like, at every single step, as opposed to just do all the things you need to do.
I think both PS4 and Xbox One will at least download all the updates in the background, so you only have to install them, which that's usually the thing that's sort of the blocker in all of it, is the fact that you have to wait for the download to happen between all the steps. Like, if all, you know, however many hundreds of megs is just sitting on your hard drive, and it's just like, install this, installing, done. Install this, installing, done. Then it wouldn't be as big a deal. But the fact that it's like, all right, I got to install this thing. All right, wait for 20 minutes for it to download. All right, now go to the next step. All right, now I got to wait 15 minutes for that thing to download. Like, that's the thing that makes the whole business untenable right now.
And that's the kind of stuff I'm surprised, you know, doesn't show up in reviews typically, you know, because I don't know if I ever remember reading a PS3 review where they're like, yeah, it took, you know, 20 minutes to install, even though that actually is a, you know, it's something worth noting. It's probably not going to ultimately change my purchase decision, but it still seems like something that, you know, we should call out and say, hey, don't do that. Which, by the way, to its credit, Infamous for PS4 didn't do that. So I just plugged it in and I was playing in like 5 minutes. And I'm sure part of that was I had just updated the system software, but there was no install step. And I hope that's a general trend for PS4 games compared to PS3 games.
I think that now on the Xbox One and the PS4, there's some more system level support for doing installs essentially while the game is playing.
Okay.
Maybe it's more on the PS4 than the Xbox One, because the Xbox One, the original plan was for it to be like download only, and so you can depend on the game coming off the hard drive. Like, all Xbox One games, I believe, fully install to the hard drive, and you never read anything off the disc. Like, the disc is basically just your license key once you've installed the game. The PS4, I think you can install to the hard drive, but you know, you've got some APIs of like, okay, just install the essential data and then tell it, here's the other stuff that I want you to install in the background while I'm playing, and it'll stream it off the hard drive while you're playing if it needs to and stuff like that. But I don't know the details because I checked out of the console industry before that stuff started coming down the pipe. So I've only sort of heard secondhand from people I know that are working on these things. But it sounds like there's a lot of new stuff there on the new consoles.
I want to say, I haven't looked into this, but I remember hearing something that, like, there's actually infrastructure support, at least for PS4 games, to start to basically do streaming downloads so you can start playing the game before it's fully downloaded. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing that it's intended for, is not so much pulling off the disk drive, though it has the nice side effect of that. It's so that you can start playing. You can basically say, I'm going to buy this game, and it'll churn for 20 minutes, and then you can start playing, but it's only downloaded like 3% of the game or something like that. But you get to start playing right away.
Yeah, because most of the game is just content and content and content, right?
Yeah. That sort of thing. I mean, not to pull us dangerously back on topic now that we're in the after section, but, you know, that's a good example of something where I don't know that calling out an individual game on that is productive, just from the standpoint of there's so many people that do it, right? Like saying, oh, I've got a bug up my butt about, games that have this install time, and I review a game that was particularly egregious, so I'm going to like dock it 5 points for having this long install time. Well, there's so many games that do that, and it's so much a part of like what the frustrations with this round of consoles, the last round of consoles were, that all that docking someone, all that docking someone points for that is going to just punish a particular developer for the crimes of the entire industry.
I like the idea of having a review site where you have like five components to the review instead of like, you know, video and audio and stuff like that. It's like the crappiness of the menus, the install time, sexism, and like, you know, like five things that are your pet things that you feel strongly that are a problem in games, and then you review them on those five things, and then you make like a Metacritic.
I would hate to see the cross section of the sexism aggregate across the games, because that would be, I could see that being a really, I mean, one, an interesting statistic to data mine, but two, it'd be probably quite depressing, I would imagine.
Well, you have the classic of the only objective review system ever, which is the old man Murray timed crate. So they would do reviews of games, and the only review metric was how long did they play the game before the first time they saw a crate.
Wow.
And they just ordered games based on that.
Wow. So, until they saw a crate.
Did either of you ever read Old Man Murray back in its heyday?
No.
So this is like a gaming humor site. Probably it's been defunct for at least 10 years that was run by I can't remember their last names. Eric and Chet are their first names. They're now writers at Valve. Like, they worked on the Portal games, among others. But yeah, it's a fantastic, I think it's still alive. Like, they haven't changed anything on it in like 10 years, but I think the site is still there. Old man, it's not even auto completing it.
I really would love to see that search query.
There we go. Old man Murray is still here.
I found an article from 2000 on the crate review system, which is I'll add it to the show
notes. That's definitely well worth a read. That and their thing about the problem with adventure games is another one that's fairly insightful. The death of adventure games. Yeah, that's a good one too.
So, what have you guys been playing, just out of curiosity? So I did Infamous and Strider recently, but
I'm playing Assassin's Creed 4, which is a lot better than 3 in my opinion. I've been playing Hearthstone on Patrick Gibson's recommendation, and it's actually better than I expected. Like, when you say it's a combination of World of Warcraft and Magic the Gathering, I expect not exactly a really, like, I don't know, but that's about as geeky as you could get as far as combination goes. But the balance of it and the feel of it, and it's incredibly sort of polished for something that's supposedly a beta. So I'm enjoying those two.
I haven't been playing anything the last couple weeks because I've been on vacation. I can't remember what I was playing before that. Obviously didn't really stick with me very well if I can't remember it.
But what are you planning on playing next?
I don't know. I have to look at my game shelf.
We're in this low in between. Neither of us have PS4s yet, but the PS3 game train is mostly dead. So I've been picking up some PC games. Like, I played Papers, Please recently, which is fun, and some of this stuff. But probably now I've heard Infamous, and that's like the first game that somebody has said, okay, this is really feels like a next generation game. It's not just something from the previous generation, and the graphics are slightly better and the controller is different. And that's the kind of thing that motivates me to actually get off my butt. And I'd like to be able to just disconnect the PS3 and then plug in the PS4 rather than...
Yeah, I thought about that. I realized I have so many PS3 games that I still want to play and am planning to play. You know, I bounced back and forth a little bit. I mean, there was a lull right after Christmas for PS4 titles. So I went back and played some of Beyond Two Souls, which is awesome. I talked about it a little bit in Low Earth Orbit, and then more recently I started playing a little bit of Ni No Kuni, which is very good. Although I'm the battle system is a little weird, so it's a little hard for me to kind of keep going back to it because it's not, you know, the world is awesome, but I really wish they would just. It's this problem I have with like pseudo real time battle systems where, you know, it's not quite fully turn-based, and it's not full real time. So it's a sort of uncanny valley combination of them where I feel
kind of the worst of both.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite that bad, but it's like, it's so close to being really good that, you know, why not just the thing that keeps going through my mind while I'm playing is like, you've done basically walked up to the doorstep of just making an action RPG, of making it, you know, full on Zelda. Why not just remove that last layer of sort of artificial, you know, obstacle and just let me play the game? Like, I'm just constantly like, no, really, I can play the game. Like, you can just let me swing the sword. It'll be fine. You know, Zelda's done it for 25 years. There's really no problem with that. And I wish I could kind of get into the mind of the developer and understand why it is they wouldn't just, you know, go that one extra step and just let me play the game, because everything else is so gorgeous about it and so wonderful. And I don't regret, you know, playing it, but it's just such a weird, you know, almost there thing that I can't quite understand why they made that decision.
Well, you need to at least promise both of us that you did not unplug your PS3 until you've played The Last of Us. Any other?
I have,
PS3
yes.
Game?
Yeah, it's funny. So Justin.
So it sounds like they might be doing a PS4 version of it. That's the.
Yeah, that's
the
interesting.
Rumblings.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? That could just be someone thought they should, so they decided they were going to, and that's how the rumors started. But
well, it was an actual statement by I forget which, I think it was the EMEA region or something. It was somebody from, it was an actual Sony representative. I think it was a vice president, and he basically said, well, I can't comment on, we should dig up, you know, what the link is, but he said, I can't comment on a new Last of Us game or anything like that, but I can tell you that the current Last of Us is going to be playable on PS4 this summer with all the DLC. I mean, it was a straight up statement. Sony came in and swooped in and said, whoa, we don't want to announce that yet. You know, so they kind of retracted it. But it wasn't just a rumor that emanated. It was an actual Sony VP saying something. So I think that means that it's actually going to happen. But yeah, that's one of those games that Justin, so one of the other co-hosts on Low Earth Orbit, he said it was like his favorite game last year. And I wasn't really sure I was going to play it because it's sort of I'm not a huge zombie fan, and the violence kind of seemed like a turnoff to me. But he's like, no, you really need to play this. So I've actually got his copy borrowed sitting in my house on my table right now. So that's my next one to hit up.
I'm so sick of zombies, like at another level.
Yeah.
Like movies, books, everything. Like TV, I don't care about another zombie thing. But Last of Us was one that had enough people saying I have to play it that I played it. And yeah, definitely glad.
Yeah, it's well worth it. It's fantastically well put together. I had to give the slight edge to Bioshock Infinite for favorite game last year, just because I'm a stealth game person, and the stealth in Last of Us is not particularly well done, whereas the shooting in Bioshock Infinite I thought was exceptionally well done. So I have to give it like the slight edge in that respect, but The Last of Us, I don't think the plot overreaches and falls short quite as much as Bioshock Infinite does. Like, it's a way more ordinary, unambitious story, whereas Bioshock Infinite's very ambitious, but it also makes less missteps than Bioshock Infinite does. So,
yeah, stealth is such an interesting thing, because I've really long thought, it's whenever you're seeing a demo video, like some sort of developer diary or a trailer or something, of the stealth element of a game, I'm always like, yes, that's awesome. I totally want to do that thing. And then I sit down and I just find myself in these situations where I'm like waiting for 20 minutes for somebody to just walk into the right room so I can run past. And I'm always like, I know there's some sort of mechanism that will make all that stuff happen, but I feel like the developer knows what the rules are. You know, they've actually constructed the system. But to me, it's always like, it's so ambiguous what it is you're supposed to be doing. And for me, it's like whenever I remember watching like the Batman animated series, you know, growing up, and it was always like, I want that experience. I want to feel overpowered when it comes to stealth. And that to me is the fun. It's like, you are a stealth expert. You're playing as like Batman and they cannot see you. But there's something weird about video games where they think
there are stealth games that are, that I think have gotten over that. How many of you played Dishonored at all?
I played a little bit of it. I kind of think I want to go back and play it on PC because it's a little awkward with the controller. But I
played it on Xbox 360 and it didn't bother me, though I can certainly see it playing better on the PC. But it, I found, gave you a lot of interesting tools. And because it's one of these, yeah, you can stealth things, but you can also kind of brute force things. So you've got a bit of a fallback position if stealth goes wrong. Whereas basically in Last of Us, like if you screw up the stealth, your face just instantly gets eaten. Like,
yeah, I get that. I mean, I get having the options, but what I want, you know, from a stealth game, or at least a stealth game, it doesn't have to be all stealth games, is in the same sense that you're typically as an action game, you're sort of overpowered in terms of like melee ability or weapons or whatever. I mean, and BioShock Infinite is a great example, right? You've got these vigors that nobody else has. And it's sort of kind of weird from a story perspective.
Which is a little strange given that they're sold on every street corner.
Yeah. So it's weird, but it also makes the game a lot of fun. I mean, for me personally. But so for some reason, I don't understand why developers are so afraid to do that for stealth. It's like, why not give you the ability, even if it's kind of metered in some way, you know, why not give you the ability to just sort of absolutely trounce your enemies with stealth, as opposed to sort of saying, well, we're going to give you ridiculous amounts of firepower. If you also try really hard and you do a lot of trial and error, you might also be able to do the stealth thing. But why not, you know, kind of at least equalize those or maybe even flip them so that the stealth stuff is not quite easy, but you feel like there's no, you really have to try hard to get it completely wrong. And right now I feel like by default you get it wrong.
Yeah, you should definitely give Dishonored a try, because I think Dishonored's a little farther in that direction. Like, you've got a real arsenal of stealth tools and kind of unique stealth tools, like things that I haven't seen before. There's certainly been other games that have introduced like one or two new mechanisms. Like the Arkham series has the sort of, you know, move between perches and drop down on people stuff for its stealth. Assassin's Creed has the like environmental stealth where you have areas that you can walk into that you sort of stealth. Last of Us has the like audio based stealth where it's about whether or not they're going to hear you. And so, you know, you've got a couple games over the last while that have introduced these sort of one new element, but Dishonored just dumps on a whole bunch of new, really interesting techniques and has a good action-y kind of fallback that you can, you know, you can screw up the stealth and still keep going rather than insta-failing. And you can have that like just darting around, taking people out left and right thing. Like, once you get the powers really dialed in, you can be vicious with the stealth takedowns and stuff like that.
And then there's interesting consequences if you do that.
Yeah, that's a game where you can choose to actually. Yeah, so I played a little bit of it, and I think that was the game where you can actually choose to complete the entire game potentially without actually killing anybody.
Yes.
And that affects, you know, what level of, I think, chaos? Is that the item or the concept they have? It's like the more people you kill, the worse the world gets, kind of.
And the game actually gets kind of harder as you kill more people, which is interesting. And that's something that I think a lot of stealth games or games that have a stealth component do wrong. Like, they make the running in guns blazing the easy mode, and they make the not killing anyone the hard mode.
Yeah.
Whereas I like this idea that it's like, okay, the not killing anyone is sort of like the sort of intended path. But if you want to be a total jerk, then you can. That's the difficult way of getting through the game.
Well, in Dishonored, you also have both lethal and non-lethal takedowns, right? Like, you have the basic, like sneak up behind the guy, and you can either knock him out or you can kill him just with the basic takedown. And then you've also got the various powers that you get, like the possession stuff and the like. Dissolve guys when you stealth take down them and stuff like that, that up the violence from a sort of story standpoint, in that, yeah, you're killing more people, but it doesn't really change how you play the game. Like, you're still playing a stealth game. It's just you sneak up behind the guy and grab him, and instead of knocking him out, he just, you know, dies and dissolves in like a cloud of flies or something like that.
Alrighty. Well, thanks for joining us. Cloud of Flies. That's the end.